Welcome to the Voice of Truth on 103.3 WAJR-FM, the radio broadcast ministry of Christian Apostolic Church in Clarksburg, West Virginia. And now, your host, author, teacher, and pastor, Doug Joseph.
Last Sunday was Sanctity of Human Life Sunday, and you may be aware that between last Sunday and this Sunday was the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. As a matter of fact, the anniversary fell on the day that I was in my home studio recording what you're hearing right now. And in just a few moments, we're going to bring you some helpful tips on how we can win the pro-life debate. But first, a delightful story about so-called junk DNA having been proven to not be junk after all. Back in 2009, Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion, was gloriously rejoicing in the fact that a massive amount of the human genome was considered at that time to be junk DNA. This was taken as rock-solid scientific fact, and he felt that this was very embarrassing for creationists. Why would an intelligent designer design a bunch of junk into our genome? In 2010, in my very first novel, I made a prediction that all of the genome would be found not to be junk, non-functioning, as the evolutionists were claiming, but that it would all, every shred of it, be found to have a purpose that was at first so wonderful and so sublime that it was beyond the comprehension of earlier scientists. Little did I realize that scientific support for my prediction would come so quickly. Let me read to you from an article found on evolutionnews.org. This was published in September of 2012. In a BBC-sponsored debate with Richard Dawkins, Britain's chief rabbi, Lord Jonathan Sacks, tweaked Dawkins on the ENCODE project results. He does it right out of the box. In the opening moments of the encounter, observing that whereas until recently 98% of the genome was, quote, dismissed as junk DNA, actually that 98% that people thought was junk isn't junk at all. It's absolutely essential to the maintenance of life. Rabbi Sacks provides an important lesson not only in science and philosophy, but in the human art of treating an opponent with unfailing grace, warmth, and a genuine friendliness that can't be faked and that disarms even Richard Dawkins. On the junk DNA point, though, Dawkins manages to squirm out and seems to turn it to his own advantage at about 13 minutes into the video. In his telling now, remember this was in 2012, in contradiction to what Dawkins said in 2009, in his telling now, the discovery that junk DNA is not junk at all isn't a blow to Darwinist predictions, but, yes, you guessed it, exactly what a Darwinist would expect. Here's the quote from Dawkins. I've noticed that there are some creationists who are jumping on the ENCODE results because they think that's awkward for Darwinism. Quite the contrary, it's exactly what a Darwinist would hope for, to find usefulness in the living world. Whereas we thought that only a minority of the genome was doing something, namely that minority which actually codes for protein, and now we find that actually the majority of it is doing something. What it's doing is calling into action the protein coding genes. So you can think of the protein coding genes as being sort of the toolbox of subroutines, which is pretty much common to all mammals. Mice and men have the same number, roughly speaking, of protein coding genes, and that's always been a bit of a blow to self-esteem of humanity. But the point is that that was just the subroutines that are called into being. The program that's calling them into action is the rest of the genome, which had previously been written off as junk. End quote. The writer on evolutionnews.org says, if I had been whispering at Rabbi Sacks' elbow, I would have suggested he point out that Dawkins has changed his tune. Back in 2009, in The Greatest Show on Earth, pages 332 and 333, he, Dawkins, was presenting the supposed junkiness of the vast majority of the genome as an assured scientific reality, and one that is, in the case of pseudogenes, quote, useful for embarrassing creationists. Here's the quote from Dawkins. It stretches even their creative ingenuity to make a convincing reason why an intelligent designer should have created a pseudogene, a gene that does absolutely nothing and gives every appearance of being a superannuated version of a gene that used to do something, unless he was deliberately setting out to fool us. Dawkins goes on, Leaving pseudogenes aside, it is a remarkable fact that the greater part, 95% in the case of humans, of the genome might as well not be there for all the difference it makes, end quote. That was in 2009, just 3 years ago. Back then, the purported fact that 95% of the human genome, quote, might as well not be there, was an embarrassment, quote, for creationists. Well, in other words, junk DNA is just what a Darwinist would expect. Cut to 2012, and now, the evident fact that junk DNA isn't junk at all, but is instead vital for life, has become, quote, exactly what a Darwinist would hope for, namely, to find usefulness in the living world. In other words, heads you lose, tails I win. A wonderful man like Rabbi Sacks would probably have to shed his courtliness for a moment to properly call out Dawkins on this blatant, unacknowledged, and suspiciously convenient self-contradiction. But as we already knew, being a Darwinist means never having to say, I was wrong. That wraps up the article, but let me quickly summarize. Darwinists claim that since we evolved, the process of evolution is sloppy and doesn't clean up after itself, and therefore there are vestiges left over from earlier stages, and our DNA was supposedly full of all these useless vestiges from bygone eras. And they look to this as a solid scientific fact and as proof that creationists are off their rocker. And of course, creationists believe that God, in his ingenious design, is not going to have the vast majority of our genome be junk. It's interesting that once science proves a support for us and cuts a blow to them, they change their story and say, no, this is exactly what we would hope to find. Well, getting back to the fact that we have just come past the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, we want to bring some information to you that will help you. First of all, I want to stress that you need to go to the West Virginians for Life website and click into their YouTube channel and watch the wonderful scholarly presentation, the academic data and research that they presented at the special event last Sunday. Did you know that abortion increases a woman's chance of suicide, depression, medical problems? It even reduces her life expectancy. This increases exponentially. These dangers increase exponentially depending on how many abortions she has. In fact, not only does abortion shorten life expectancy, but natural birth actually extends life expectancy. There was just such a wealth of information showing the damage that is done to women by abortion. And of course, you're not going to get these kinds of statistics in the mainstream media because they are in the back pocket of the abortion industry, which is a huge money-making thing. It's really all about the dollars. Alveda King, the niece of Martin Luther King Jr., made this statement regarding black women and how they are victimized by the abortion industry. And when she says this, bear in mind that one in every two African-American pregnancies end in abortion. Let me say that again. One in every two African-American pregnancies end in abortion. Thank God that there are now many black leaders standing up against this injustice. But here's the quote by Alveda King, Martin Luther King Jr.'s niece. When we said we will no longer sit on the back of the bus, a place was being reserved for us down at the abortion clinic. Well, I mentioned that we wanted to bring you some tips on how pro-lifers can win the abortion debate. And for that, I want to read to you from an article on lifenews.com. Coming out of Washington, D.C., it's written by Cassie Fiano. And she is publishing here her interview with Scott Klusendorf. This is a fascinating man, and you're going to greatly appreciate what he has to say. Scott founded the Life Training Institute in order to create a ministry that could train pro-lifers to effectively get our message across with the goal of saving lives. She spoke to Scott to find out why he founded the Life Training Institute and how pro-lifers can strengthen our message and what we should do moving forward. When he's asked to tell about himself, he says, I'm president of Life Training Institute and I've been a pro-life apologist full-time for 21 years. My purpose in life is to equip pro-lifers to make a case for life in the public square. Cassie asks, have you always been pro-life? He says, I always was pro-life philosophically, meaning that there was never a time when I believed that abortion was permissible. However, there was a period in my life where, though I had pro-life sentiments, I didn't act like I believed that abortion was wrong. And it wasn't until November of 1990, when I attended a pro-life lecture by a guy named Greg Cunningham, that I was awakened to the severity of the problem in front of us. It was interesting because at the time, I was an associate pastor at a church in Los Angeles, and I went to a gathering for pastors that was supposed to be on the topic of abortion. When I showed up, rather than there being 100 of us there as I anticipated, there were 4 other pastors. So the attendance was incredibly sparse, but thankfully, Greg Cunningham gave a persuasive defense of the pro-life view. And then he showed images of abortion. I had never seen those. And I sat there and looked at those images and thought, my goodness, how can I sit here and not be involved? To make a long story short, 6 months later, I resigned my position as an associate pastor with the blessing of my church to work full-time trying to equip pro-lifers to make a case for life, and I've been at it ever since. Cassie asks, can you tell me about Life Training Institute? He answers, Life Training Institute exists to help pro-lifers, especially Catholics and Protestants, although we'll work with anybody, to make a case for life in the public square. We focus on going into Catholic and Protestant high schools and doing assemblies, classes, and presentations that communicate the moral logic of the pro-life view. We teach these students to argue persuasively pro-life view using science and philosophy. Why? Because when they graduate and get out in the real world, it's not going to work to simply say, quote, the Bible says abortion is wrong, and so does the church, so there. Moreover, if we are not reaching Christian students with pro-life content they can use with unchurched critics, then those students are going to do one of two things. They're either going to jettison their pro-life views when they head off to the university, or they're not going to be effective pro-lifers because they won't be confident in what they believe. So we try to equip people with the tools that are needed to make the case persuasively so they can do it with confidence. Cassie asks, what made you decide to start this organization? He answers, prior to my time with Life Training Institute, I worked with 2 other organizations, the Center for Bioethical Reform and Stand to Reason. Both of those groups are doing a great work, and both of those groups helped shape me into the pro-life apologist I've become. But what I noticed around the year 2002-2003 was that there wasn't a pro-life organization out there dedicated exclusively to teaching pro-life apologetics to lay people. On one hand, we had the smart pro-life philosophers, the Frank Beckwiths, the Robert Georges, the Patrick Lees, the J.P. Morelands, who are doing exceptional work, battling for our ideas at the highest philosophical levels. The problem is, lay people aren't reading those guys. And what I viewed my role as being was creating an organization that would function almost as a translator, where we would take these great ideas that were being developed by good thinkers on our side of the issue and make them understandable to lay people. I also noticed that there wasn't a pro-life group that I saw that was systematically trying to go into schools and teach a defense for the pro-life position. We had pro-life groups going in to teach abstinence, but we didn't have pro-life groups going into pro-life Catholic or Protestant schools to exclusively teach a defense for the pro-life view. In fact, it appeared to me that many people did not even want to talk about abortion anymore. They were fine talking about abstinence, they were fine talking about crisis pregnancy centers and the work they do with women, but to specifically talk about abortion and making a case for the pro-life view, that wasn't even on their radar. So I said, we need to create an organization that would be dedicated exclusively to that. Cassie asks, many pro-choicers like to claim that the scientific evidence is on their side to support abortion. However, your website says that scientific evidence shows that life begins at conception. Can you discuss that? Well, I've found very few pro-abortion advocates in formal debate settings that I've been involved in that will deny the scientific facts. It's really hard to do. Every embryology textbook out there says that each of us began as a single-celled zygote. That is beyond medical dispute. What they generally try to do is argue that each and every human being does not have an equal right to life, that only some have it by virtue of some accidental property like self-awareness, which may come and go in our lifetime. Those few that do try to argue that the science is on their side typically say one of two things. First, they'll say, how can you say that it is a distinct, living, whole human being when twinning can occur? After all, that single-celled zygote can grow, and around up to the 14 to 21-day period, that zygote can split into two entities. So, how can we claim that you've got a living member of the human family from the very beginning? Well, that argument simply doesn't work. How does it follow that because an entity may split, it wasn't a full living human prior to this split? As Patrick Lee points out, if you cut a flatworm in half, what do you end up with? Two flatworms. Does it follow there was no flatworm prior to the split? So, the fact that the entity may split does not mean it wasn't a member of the whole human family prior to the split. The other thing that they will say is, these early embryos are not really at all different from sperm and egg. They are part of a human being, but they're not distinct, living, whole human beings. We don't think, for example, that sperm and egg are a tragedy when they're lost. Why should we think embryos are? This clearly confuses parts and wholes. Sperm and eggs are merely parts of a larger human being, in this case, the man and the woman. The early embryo is not part of another human being, but is itself a distinct human living organism. If you were to imagine what I'm doing right now, you would see that I'm picking cells off of the back of my hand. I just sent a couple of hundred of those puppies hurtling to their death on the patio in front of me. But you don't think for a moment that I just committed mass homicide, and there is a reason. You know that these cells are merely part of a larger human being, me, and that they are not distinct, whole human beings the way you were when you were an embryo and the way I was when I was an embryo. Cassie asks, to go into a bit of a different direction, why do you feel that pro-lifers need training on how to best spread our message? Do you feel that the way we are presenting our beliefs is not as effective as it could be? He answers, well, in some cases, I think it's not effective. Absolutely. First, I think it's wrong when we make how abortion impacts women our primary message. There is a place for that being a secondary message, but it should never be our primary message. Abortion is wrong not merely because it adversely affects women. It's primarily wrong because it intentionally takes the life of a defenseless human being. We've got to keep our focus clear on that. A second way people argue that is poor is that they buy into the assumptions of our critics. For example, they start talking about the unborn having value because there's a heartbeat at 3 weeks, brainwaves at 6 weeks. The fetus can feel pain in the first trimester, which is questionable, by the way, and a bunch of other things they say to point to the development of the human being as proof that it's one of us. But our case does not rely on the embryo being developed. It relies on the fact that it is a member of the human species from the very beginning. We argue that abortion is wrong not because it kills a baby. We argue that it's wrong because it kills a developing human being without justification. And it doesn't matter whether that human being is an embryo, a fetus, a baby, a toddler, a teenager, or an adult. So I think those are some points we need to be clear on. The other thing we need to keep in mind is that we are in a huge idea struggle right now in our culture over two key questions. And if pro-lifers are not equipped to engage on those two questions, we'll lose this fight. We're losing it not because we're not nice enough. That's a media perception that they want the public to buy. But it's not the reason we're in trouble. Here are the two main questions that the culture is fighting over that we have to get right. Number one, the culture is fighting over the question, is truth true? In other words, is moral truth real and knowable, or is it just a preference like choosing chocolate ice cream over vanilla? Is truth true? The second question we're arguing about is, what makes human beings valuable? Are we valuable because of what we are intrinsically, meaning we have a right to life simply because we're human? Or are we valuable only because of some function we can perform that we can immediately exercise, such as self-awareness or the ability to feel pain? Those two questions of truth and human value are driving our national debate over abortion, over embryonic stem cell research, and it's critically important that pro-lifers know how to articulate their views on these questions. Cassie asks, what would you say is the biggest weakness for the pro-life side right now? What would be the number one thing we need to change? I think we need to seriously reevaluate the idea that we're winning this fight. I don't believe we are. In some ways, we are seeing progress, but overall, I do not believe we are winning. In fact, the recent Time magazine article that says pro-choicers have been losing ever since Roe, I'm not a bit persuaded by that. And let me give you a couple of reasons why. This nation just reelected the most pro-abortion president in history, who once voted against saving infants who were born alive. In fact, he didn't do it just once. He did it three times. Not only that, we lost two Senate seats specifically on the abortion issue because our candidates had no clue how to clearly articulate their views, and as a result, they got punished at the polls. Secondly, our government is now mandating that employers cover the cost of abortion-inducing drugs, and there is no huge public outcry over it. There's some in pro-life circles, but nowhere near the critical mass that we need to see it challenged and tossed out. So while we see these opinion polls that claim that pro-lifers are winning people over, in the only opinion poll that matters, a national election, we lost big time. And not only that, but our candidate ran from the ideological issues. Our opponents spoke out and made no apologies for their positions. Barack Obama made it abundantly clear what he stood for, and the public bought it. How can anyone come to the conclusion that we are winning this fight overall? Now, here's where there is some good news. Just because I think we're not winning at the moment doesn't mean I think we're not ever going to win, nor do I think that that's an excuse for quitting. Surrender is not an option. Here's where we're doing well. Number one, we're seeing a student pro-life movement step forward. We're seeing groups like Students for Life of America, Stand to Reason, and Ratio Christi that are saying, we want to get pro-life presentations on campus. We want to see pro-lifers make a difference there, and pro-life students now have a place to go. 10 years ago, they didn't. So that's a very encouraging sign. Number two, Planned Parenthood has been undermined to some degree thanks to the work of Live Action, Lila Rose, and others. We see Planned Parenthood now having to fight a public relations battle that they weren't having to fight 10 years ago. That is very good news. Third, I see a resurgence in Christian worldview training, where high school and college students who are Christians want to be equipped to defend their views in the public square so that when they get to college, they won't get run over by secular philosophers and professors. I think that's a good sign. I also think it's a good sign that pregnancy centers are in a position where they outnumber abortion clinics. They still struggle to reach abortion-minded clients, but they're at least in a position to make a difference, and they give our movement credibility. So I'm not despairing, but I don't want to be overly optimistic and make the claim that we're winning. Cassie asks, what can we do to start winning this war on abortion then? Scott answers, number one, pro-life groups, all of them, not just a few of us, but all of us, have to systematically train people to make a simple case for the pro-life view. We don't have to go around saying, go get a PhD, but every pro-life advocate has got to know how to defend his beliefs in 2 minutes or less. First, he needs to be able to argue the science, that the science of embryology establishes from the earliest stages of development that each of us is a whole living human being. We had yet to mature, but what we were was not in question. Philosophically, we need to argue that there's no relevant difference between the embryos we once were and the adults we are today that would justify killing us at an earlier stage. Differences in size, level of development, and environment, meaning where we're located and degree of dependency, are not good reasons for saying you could be killed then, but not now. In fact, I've even got an article on our website called How to Defend Your Pro-Life Views in 5 Minutes or Less. The truth is, you can do it in 2 minutes or less if you have to. We've got to make sure that Catholic and Protestant people, lay people, understand that argument, can articulate it to friends, and that has to be done. Second thing we've got to do, we've got to get more people working full-time to save unborn human beings. Greg Cunningham has a great quote. He says, there are more people working full-time to kill babies than there are working full-time to save them. And that's because killing babies is very profitable, while saving them is very costly. so costly that large numbers of people who say they are pro-life are not lifting a finger to stop the killing, and those that do lift a finger do just enough to salve the conscience, but not enough to stop the killing. I think that quote nails it. And so our organization, beginning this summer in Fort Wayne, Indiana, will begin offering at our Friends for Life camp a support-raising seminar to go along with the apologetics training that we already offer there. That will enable recent college grads and soon-to-be college grads to learn how to raise their own financial support so they can work full-time on the pro-life issue. The problem is, as you know, there's no pro-life group out there that has any money to hire any new staff. We're all flat broke. But what if we could get new employees who raise their own financial support so that they could work for us without bankrupting our organizations? That's the kind of model that groups like Campus Crusade for Christ, the Navigators, Mission Aviation Fellowship, etc., have used for years to get full-time people into the field making a difference. Why can't we do the same? Cassie asks, Planned Parenthood recently did a poll and claimed that Americans have started to shy away from the terms pro-life and pro-choice and are reluctant to label themselves as either. And so, Planned Parenthood is now abandoning the term pro-choice. Should pro-lifers change how we label ourselves? Scott answers, This may sound odd, but I really don't think labeling is that big a deal one way or the other. I think what matters is the argument we present, that ultimately that's what's going to carry the day. Our opponents can call us anything they want. I'm quite content to stick with the term pro-life. I don't see anything wrong with it. That's what we are. We believe that it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Pro-life describes accurately what our position is, so I don't see any need to change that. I don't get that upset, though, when someone calls me anti-abortion. I am anti-abortion. I am against the intentional killing of an innocent human being. I do think we may need to, in a culture that is dominated by the tyranny of cliches, explain what our position is. And however we may choose to label ourselves, it will not relieve us of our responsibility to make cogent arguments. Cassie asks, Now for a more personal type of question. Many pro-choicers claim that men should not have a voice on abortion. As a pro-life man, what would your response to that be? Scott says, Well, my first response is that arguments don't have gender. People do. If we're going to say that only women can speak on abortion, then we have to reverse Roe v. Wade because it was decided by 9 men. Furthermore, we'd have to take all the male attorneys working for Planned Parenthood and the ACLU and toss them out of their jobs because, after all, only women have a right to speak on abortion. That's a crazy argument. It's what is known as an ad hominem argument. You attack the person rather than the argument he's making. Pro-life women use the same arguments as pro-life men to defend the unborn. You have to argue on the merits of your case, not attack someone because you don't like his gender. Imagine if I said to a woman sportscaster, you have no right to broadcast a football game because you don't know what it's like to be kicked in the groin. Someone would say that's a terribly sexist remark, and I agree. Why would it be any different then when it comes to an issue like abortion? My arguments are either true or false, valid or invalid. They don't change because of my gender. Cassie says, This is the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. What should pro-lifers do on the anniversary? Scott responds, On a personal level, they should dedicate themselves to some serious study to master the pro-life view. They should pick up books like The Case for Life, Peter Kreef's book, The Unaborted Socrates. There's just 2 books that will get them started. I would recommend a third as well, and that is Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. Because at the bottom of all these abortion choice arguments is a worldview known as relativism, which says that right and wrong are up to personal choice. We need to know how to combat that. Second thing I think pro-lifers need to do, they need to participate in the big events. There's nothing wrong with marches and rallies. I'm not against those things. I am against them only if it's all we're doing. If we go to the March for Life in Washington and then go home and don't apply ourselves to make a persuasive case for our view with friends and co-workers and fellow students, we've dropped the ball. So let us go to the big rallies and marches. Those will strengthen us and let us know that we don't fight alone. But let's also study to be equipped. The third thing we've got to do is stay engaged politically. Just because our ideas are not popular right now does not mean they're wrong, nor does it mean we should surrender the political field. We've got to stay engaged, and we've got to continue to promote the good and oppose the evil, insofar as possible, given the current political realities.
Thank you for listening. You can reach us online at cac.us.com. Catch the Voice of Truth broadcast each Sunday morning at 11:30 right here on Talk Radio 103.3 WAJR-FM.